Be supportive. Like, you have to share the wins. The small wins are very important. The more times you share those wins and let people feel like, you know, commending the work they've done, it goes a long way. Just yeah. little pieces here and there.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Christine Minotto. I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. And welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. Today, we are talking to Karim Barghouti, a biodesign fellow at the TMC Innovation Institute in Houston and co-founder of Vast Biome. In the biodesign process, you start with an unmet need. The need that Karim and his team identified comes from cancer immunotherapy, where therapies are very expensive, can be toxic, and only work in 20% of patients. Karim and his team want to help pharma companies increase that success rate. To do this, they are using computational methods to analyze the microbiomes of patients that respond to therapy and figure out which bacteria are involved and what molecules they may be producing that help the body fight cancer. Karim has an MBA from Duke with a specialization in healthcare and a very interesting background that includes entrepreneurship and a stint in digital marketing at Google. Enjoy our conversation. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Well, welcome, Karim. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so maybe we can start with a little bit background about yourself. Now you are starting this company more in the healthcare space, but your background came from the tech side.
Correct.
And before we go there, like, how do you end up from the tech to where you are today? Can we, you know, have a better understanding?
Of course, yeah. So I grew up in a Middle Eastern culture. Mm-hmm. And in my family, usually you will become either an engineer or a doctor. Those are the two options that your parents give you. And for me, I was always actually very passionate about the healthcare space, taking care of my own body and understanding how it works. So I did go into college at UC Irvine studying biology. I did get my degree in, it was pre-med, expecting to go into medicine afterwards. But when I was in my last year of college, I actually ended up getting a lot of interest in the technology sector. And one of my friends, actually my roommate and I, thought, well, let's maybe start a company while we're in school and something that we think is an unmet need that can really help address a problem that that relates to us.
Okay.
And so we started
a company
called Stingy Campus.
Stingy Campus, that's a good name.
And the name basically it represents Craigslist, but just for students.
Okay.
At your own university.
So they offer housing,
exactly.
selection, and
student
furniture.
Discounts, furniture, textbooks. Just to get to know people, also housing, yes.
But it's not like quite Facebook or anything like that.
No, it's not a social. It's social in terms of finding opportunities for whatever needs you have for school.
Okay.
And getting that started was a pretty interesting experience. We were both a biology background. And
both of you are
both
biology.
Of us. And then we met another colleague who comes from the computer science school and helped us build out our beta version of the product. And I was getting very excited about and learning how technology works and how to build a business around it. And so when we graduated, we were fortunate to raise a small round to help us kickstart things.
Okay. And so you did all this programming before with no money?
No money. Yeah. Yeah. Just finding the right people who believed in us.
Okay.
And when you're young and you have some, you know, good friends, you know, we're all just doing some fun projects while we're in school. So it wasn't too challenging to find the right people. And built some traction and got our university on board and about 12 other universities around Southern California and really built an understanding of how to build an MVP for your product, a minimal viable product.
You mentioned you got seed money.
Seed money was about $250,000 from an angel, just believed in the idea. And so learning about the fundraising process was also a challenging process, but, you know, very valuable to understand. And so it should really make you think about your business, not just about the technology, because that's really the
purpose. Do you get any help during that time from any of the school resources or something that you just Google everything up?
Honestly, it was just doing it and reading about it and talking to people. It was just a combination of many things, going to networking events, a lot of the stuff it could be valuable and some of the stuff was not so valuable. So you just have to take what you learn and put it together for what makes sense for you.
Okay. And so where do you get the seed money and how do you find the seed money? I mean, I imagine you must be like, what, 21 at that time?
I was 21 years old, yes. We didn't really know where to look. We just started talking to people who we knew that were wealthy. It was angels. We went to some events that are catered towards angel networks. I went to UCLA. They had this first year entrepreneurship startup pitch program where they wanted young entrepreneurs to go and pitch their ideas. And we met a network of entrepreneurs there. And then we were fortunate to find an angel who was excited about us and liked how professional we were and had some traction in technology. You got sort of some traction of your, you know, people actually like your product. So that was a good start. And they just believed in us, to be honest. It was surprising. Yeah. It was very great. And so it really helped us put the foundation of how to move from there. And then we just took off for a few more years, try to understand how to build the product and find the right customer acquisition and thinking about the revenue streams and then building relationships with different partners. You know, we had about 20,000 active users, about 200 small companies who are advertising on our website to get in front of students.
So and all you need is 250,000 and then you got revenue. Then you don't, you never have to raise money anymore for that.
Not necessarily. So money is for different purposes. You know, some of it is for building the product. Other parts I learned the hard way is legal. A lot of legal and the costs that go into building
That's why your parents should tell you to go become a lawyer.
that's another option, yes. And then, of course, when you want to scale your business, it's just going to take more resources and a lot of different factors to go into it. So you, if you want to stay small, you can work based off the revenue that you're making, you can survive. But there's always competitors and everyone's going to try to surpass you. So
So you raised additional funding?
No, we didn't raise any additional for that. So we learned a lot about the challenges of, and I can go into more detail if you'd like, on all the different things that go into building a viable product and how to make sure you're capturing the right audience and retaining your users. And we try to do too much at one time. So I learned all of these pitfalls of that you should stay away from as an entrepreneur when you're trying to build a business. That was all just learning on the go. You know, no one actually told us. We were given, as the angel was very, what was great about him, they gave us a lot of autonomy. So just go do what you got to do and then come back to me weekly, give me a report.
Do you put together in some sort of adult supervision advisors?
We definitely try to find the right people and looking back now, I don't think we did find the right people, but you take what you can find at that point. And
why do you think, looking back, it's not the right people now?
Their expertise was not the right fit. And I think you need to speak to successful entrepreneurs who've really done it in terms of getting your advice rather than business consultants. Entrepreneurs will give you a very different advice, in my experience, than what someone who works for a large company and understands how to build products. But going from zero to one, you know, that book from Peter Thiel is very challenging and a very different skill set of understanding what it takes. And that's not the advice we were getting from the people we were speaking to, but we did not know who was the right person to talk to. Again, 21 years old, we learned a lot. So I got my business degree through doing this.
Well, you save your business, your tuition.
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, so that's was all the whole time working on this. I joined another startup after we didn't get enough traction, which is fine. We were very satisfied with what we learned. I was fortunate to join a company called Wildfire Interactive. It was a social media software, a SaaS product, software as a service, where they were getting tremendous traction and had built already about 150 employees before I joined. One of the top known companies in the Bay Area and really growing in social media. In 2011 is when I joined them, for companies was becoming a really big thing. Brands were starting to learn how to use the internet and digital marketing and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, what they can do to capitalize on this and understanding your audience. It's no longer advertising one way. You have to have a two-way conversation with your customers. And then and build that brand presence is significantly important, especially today. So that was in the beginning of understanding how to use social media for brands. And this company, Wildfire, built a software for marketers who do not really necessarily know how to build or code things online or use the marketing or digital services to build their brand. They're used to TV, print, magazines, the traditional advertising methods. And so what we were doing is rather than something called paid media, it's earned media. Earn your presence. Build a reputation with your customers.
Okay.
And social media is a way to do that.
And how do they do that? Do they have a platform that everybody can plug and play?
Yes. No, exactly. That's what it is. We want to make it so that a marketer does not have to code a single line. They can just go in and take what they want to do and plug it into a specific application, and then it insert it into the Facebook native home for the applications.
Okay.
And then from there, it was going really fast. Actually, Google came around and they acquired the company after about 400 or so employees.
That's
it was
great.
It was a very good experience, very exciting to see that Google came on and was willing to, because they knew that social media was becoming very important for any large, as a big company that most of their revenue comes from advertising and digital. Social media was going to be the next thing that they had to get into.
Google doesn't really have a social media.
They did have, and they're most recently, as of thing this year or late last year, Google Plus was one of their social media.
Didn't it just close?
They closed that down. Yeah. It didn't have the traction they were looking for. They don't have all the details, but they decided to discontinue. Mm-hmm. But YouTube does count as a social media. Some people don't realize YouTube is connected to, is actually a Google company. And so that is, you know, the largest amount of viewers. Second most searches are happening on YouTube.
Right.
Number one is Google. People don't realize. Number two is YouTube.
It's another Google.
Yeah. So that was a big opportunity for them to start capitalizing on building a social media software that can help their customers.
Okay.
And when we got acquired, I was in a sales role working with helping brands adopt social media. And then I moved on to helping brands with adopting advertising, Google's core product.
Okay.
How to, if you've never done digital marketing yet, how can we help you build a presence online?
Okay.
So we're almost like an agency, an internal at Google, that we help you build your foundation and help you scale your business.
So that Google make more money.
Make more money, but also make the customers more money.
Yeah.
That's my number one thing. So if the customers are making money, then Google's happy.
So you done that for a while at Google?
I did it for a couple of years in that particular role. And then I transitioned. I got an opportunity to go to London to work on a rotational team where I was building out a brand new product from scratch. So they will select people every once in a while to say, hey, you're doing great in your job. Maybe you want to try something completely different. So I got to join a product team, a product marketing team.
Okay.
And have the chance to build something called a MOOC, a Mass Online Open Course, which is basically online courses for free.
Okay.
Sometimes you pay for them. And we built a presence, a platform for anyone who wants to learn about digital marketing. They can come to this website, start taking courses and quizzes and certifications, primarily for the European market at that point.
Okay.
And so I learned about how to build a product from the best of the best, right? So working with the best engineers, the best product managers, the best marketers, and what it takes to get all these different stakeholders to work together. That's really what it comes down to in execution.
And you got to live in London.
And London was amazing. I really enjoyed it there. And there's a lot of great things happening and from the technology community as well. So I really enjoy that.
And how do you make the jump from Google to doing your own startup in the healthcare
space? The whole time, I was always still passionate about healthcare. And so on the side, I was trying to think about startups still. I want to go back to the entrepreneurial industry, a field. But where? You know, how am I going to get involved? And healthcare is very different than what I've been doing. So, but my intention was to always be the business person on part of this team, whatever team I joined. But I wanted to find the right people to help me build something very special, something that can be valuable. And while I was at Google in the last couple of years, I actually was getting my MBA through Duke. And when I went to Duke, so it was a working/travel program. We went to go global, but we also went to Durham to take our courses.
Okay.
And Duke is known for something called healthcare sector management. It's one of the top programs understanding the landscape of healthcare and where all the challenges from the provider, payer, and then the pharmaceutical industry, just a wide landscape of understanding what's going on.
It's a 2 years program?
It's a 2 year program, program. So you're still going
to. It's part time, too.
It's full time course, but you're still working. So part time is usually 3 years. They don't have a part time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very intense.
Google paid for it, I hope.
Not as much as you'd like, but that's fine. You know, it was valuable to me. And so I wanted to make sure I wanted to get a legitimate foundation in business rather than learning on my own, but learning about the accounting, the finance, the operations, marketing, all that from a great institution, but also understanding where in healthcare are there unmet needs that I might be interested in participating in.
Okay.
So
you finished that? And
finished that. But before I finished that, I met one of my mentors had told me about a program called Biodesign. So he did it at Stanford, and he was one of the first classes, and he had a great experience. And essentially, it talks about biodesign as a methodology for identifying unmet needs right. in healthcare and trying to address them with a solution that you can find after you really validate there is an unmet need. Mm-hmm. And what's different about the program I went to was not at Stanford. It was in Houston at the Texas Medical Center, something called the TMC Innovation Institute. And so as soon as I graduated, I was offered the opportunity to join as a fellow. They take 4 individuals for digital health and okay. 4 individuals for medical device.
Okay.
And for the digital health side, the backgrounds they're looking for is a business person, a physician, a computer programmer, and a product manager. So people with complementary skill set, they can, if they come together, they should be able to build some type of MVP to be mm-hmm. of value.
And so what was your theme at that year? What were your, you know... I think they usually pick an area to solve.
True. The traditional program at Stanford will give you a feel, like look into cardiology, et cetera. For us, it was do what you want. Just learn about it, which is much harder, in my opinion.
Yeah.
When you don't have an area of focus, you can't really dig deep enough to really understand the needs. So for us, we learned after 2 months in, okay, we got to restructure how we think about looking for unmet needs because there's really a lot going on here. We went to conferences. And one thing about Texas Medical Center, just to understand the Houston ecosystem, it's actually pretty impressive. It's the largest medical center in the U.S., if not the world.
Okay.
We have over 100,000 professionals in the medical community that work within this small area within Houston. So it's basically a city of hospitals and researchers and a lot of great things going on. Innovation is one of them. And so we had the opportunity to go talk to some of the best people in their fields to learn about their challenges. Mm. And we decided after a couple months, okay, where can we really focus? Because we looked at the self-funded insurance space. We looked at health IT. And then where we stumbled upon what we're most passionate about is the precision medicine field.
Okay.
At MD Anderson, there was some amazing work being done there. The head of precision medicine, Dr. Andy Futrell, who was a pathologist by training. He's actually one of the persons who identified the BRCA gene for breast cancer, very impressive background. And he told us, for our business, where we got started getting into, is if I were you, I'd be very excited about learning more about the microbiome.
Okay, which everybody does.
Which everyone says, yeah. But that was very broad, right? What do you mean by the microbiome? There's a lot going on. But in general, he said there is a key opinion leader at MD Anderson. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Wargo. And she's doing some amazing work looking at the microbiome and the role it plays in influencing patients' response to checkpoint therapy.
What is checkpoint therapy?
Checkpoint therapy is basically a category of immunotherapy where you're using your immune system to fight the cancer cells.
Okay.
So it's basically enabling the opportunity to use your immune system as the source. You know, immune system is amazing. It's how our body functions and survives and overcomes all these different diseases.
Okay.
And so we've never really unlocked how it works mm-hmm. until now that we have the technology to do that from a sequencing standpoint, from the computational standpoint. All these great opportunities are now available at our disposal. We just have to make sense of it and try to understand it.
Okay.
When we first sequenced the human genome, we thought it was going to answer so many questions.
Right.
And it just made more questions.
Well, that's more, you know, yeah.
There's a lot more going on. And the microbiome is even more complicated because there are 100 times more genes than the human genome.
Right.
So we don't know anything about how the microbiome really works. And
right.
There's a lot of great studies happening showing correlations of right. the microbiome in relation to mental health, skin diseases, cancer, digestive issues of various areas.
So you coming from all this Google experience
yeah.
and then look at microbiome, there's potential. And what do you decide that how you can make a difference and how you can come up with a solution that can solve this particular problem?
Exactly. So we try to figure out, okay, there's a connection between cancer and patient responding based on your microbiome. So what can we do with that? And we talked to Dr. Jen Wargo. We started talking to a lot of industry experts to really understand what are the challenges right now within the microbiome to really leverage it to help hopefully make better medications. And we were very fortunate to be at our disposal again within Houston, some great industry experts who really understand the field and are some of the leaders. And initially for our company, you know, as a startup, you constantly are pivoting until you really find your area and then you can show value. We were thinking about being, well, if there's some connection between cancer and your gut microbiome, what if we created a clinical trial screening process using our machine learning methods to identify the differences in patients who respond to checkpoint therapy and those that don't respond?
Okay.
And so can we look at those differences from a computational standpoint and create basically a biomarker, a test that you can see that if you're about to be put onto this treatment, can we predict you're going to respond or not ahead of time so that the pharmaceutical company can save money significantly on the cost of administering a treatment that may not work for you. Mm-hmm. Insurers can save a lot of money for paying for something that's not going to work. So a lot of benefits.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into a unique healthcare solution. For more information, visit their website at iolifescience.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So how do you, you know, as a startup, you don't have that information. You don't have the data.
Yes.
Machine learning sounds great.
Yes.
But then you need data. Like,
of course.
How do you get that?
Yeah.
How do you access that data?
And that's why I really, really value the biodesign program. We didn't just learn about the unmet need of the product, you know, the healthcare space, but like the unmet needs of individuals, the different stakeholders. And there's many different stakeholders in this field. So when we wanted to learn about, okay, well, we need data. The great thing about the healthcare space, there is a lot of public data. You know, all these researchers are publishing. The work that inspired our work came from Dr. Jen Wargo's publication, which was the front of Science magazine, as well as a University of Chicago and some work done in Paris and the different institutions who have shown some very interesting findings connecting the gut microbiome to cancer patients. So we downloaded that data from the publications and start to play around with it and try to see, can we make any further assessments that might be discoveries that no one thought of before because they did not apply our deep learning, machine learning methods that we built in-house.
How many data do you need to make your algorithm?
And the answer, and this is a question we get all the time.
What is the minimum?
Truthfully, the more the better. The more data you have, the more the better judgments you can make, and the stronger your predictions are going to be, and more accurate. But
right.
you're limited.
You come in as that you have data, and then
yes,
I mean, what is that? Of course, the more is better.
Yes,
but what is the point before people say like, okay, this makes sense. I think this something can be done.
So for us, we took all the public data we can possibly find.
Okay.
So
and how many of those?
About 10 different publications in immuno-oncology focus. Okay. And there was about, give or take, a little over 300 patients. But 300 patients across a number of indications looking at checkpoint therapy, they have within them, we're looking at the genes of the bacteria. And there's thousands of these genes. So it's not just about how many patients you have, but also what the patients are, the bacteria what are the bacteria producing from those patients? So the data set becomes thousands and thousands of different genes that we're looking at.
Okay.
Granted, yes, there's about 200, 300 patients. But that's more than anything else out there that we've seen. There have been publications and the front page of Science magazine with an N of 25 talking about this. So we are aggregating all these different publications into one. And what the value of that is, the more data, the better predictions you can make. So we did some retrospective analysis of this and have been able to show some very promising discoveries that we still want to validate, so we're not making any claims today. But the point is now we're working with other hospitals. Going back how we got the data, other than public, very important is we talk to the PIs, these investigators, principal investigators at these different academic institutions and ask them, you know, you guys are working on a great study. We'll be happy to come in as a bioinformatics and data science team to potentially, you know, help you analyze the data you're working on because they don't have the skill set in-house. Okay. They usually have a PhD student who's taking online public open source tools and trying to put something together.
Okay. And so your team has you, and then you have a data scientist.
We have three other people. Yeah, so four total team members. Yeah. Okay. So the team is composed of my job, strictly looking at the finance, the operations, business development efforts, and the legal aspect. And then Peter McCaffrey is our CTO. He comes from a strong medicine background from Hopkins and Harvard training in pathology, but also self-taught in data science and bioinformatics, has started a company in the microbial bioinformatics space before. We also have our CSO, who is Dr. Kovi Besoff. He's an MD, PhD, who trained at University of Vermont, worked in drug discovery and microbiology, and most recently a general surgery resident at Stanford. So he understands the basic science very well, which is very important to our space. And then the last person, the fourth member of our team is Ayan Vala. He is the trained data scientist in healthcare, particularly, which we make a clear of because looking at data in different applications for different industries varies. But healthcare is very different, very specific. So he co-founded the Foundation for Precision Medicine, which looks at EMR data and tries to make early signs or predictions of disease based on the thousands of different data points that they have. So combining the science understanding, the technology understanding together, we look like a very impressive team to these PIs. Mm-hmm. And they are willing to
provide free service.
We provide a free service. We're not a fee for service intentionally because we want to be able to own a copy of the data for the analysis that we provide.
Okay.
And
recently, how many PI have you work and how many?
There's seven institutions that we've had agreements upon. We're getting a couple more in the works now. And they all vary depending on what we're doing.
How do you approach this PI? I mean, how do you...
Yes. So, big challenge...
And how do they trust you with their data?
Of course. The very, very important thing is making sure you build trust. And how we initiated these conversations is we first wanted to understand what are their main pain points, what are they working on. Tell them, hey, this is our background. We took some public data. We've made some interesting discoveries. Some of our work has been even presented at some of the large conferences like AACR with a bio KOL. So build a little bit of credibility there. Being fellows at TMC always helps being a student. And so they're willing to talk to students. And then we look at them, talk to them about what they're working on. And they say, well, we've done some interesting work in this space. When you say the word data science, it really gets people's attention and say, okay, well, I would love to get access to this and I don't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And of course, building that relationship, like you got to be friendly. You know, they got to like you.
Yeah.
So a mix of, getting to know.
Did you get a warm introduction or you just cold called them?
It was mostly cold call and then through some introductions. It was a mixture of just putting ourselves out there. And
everything works. The success rate is not between cold call and
Introductions are always better. Yes, absolutely, it's always better. And because we were in the Houston ecosystem, it's a small ecosystem. You get to know people very quickly, and everyone starts referring you. If you have an advisor that everyone respects, they're willing to have a conversation with you.
Okay.
And that's how it started. And essentially, people started giving us data. And again, we're very clear. We get to own a copy of that data. Initially, it was just doing them favors so they can publish some work. And then we got accepted into the Illumina Accelerator, mm-hmm. which is right here in the Bay Area. And that was interesting and very compelling to our PIs, our partners, because we get free sequencing service, credits.
So then now, they can use your credit.
Yes.
For their
research.
Study purpose.
So now
does Illumina know?
Of course. No, that's intentional. So you're basically telling them, we will come and take your samples of my gut microbiome samples. And we will sequence it on your behalf. We have an internal method of development that we've created to get you the highest quality reads from your sequencing, basically making sure the data is very high quality. And then we will analyze it with our internal approaches that we've created internally. And then we can share that data with you and you can publish some of your work. At the same time, we get to own that data as a co-ownership. And if we want to commercialize, we have the ability to do that, whether it's going to be an inclusive or exclusive agreement. It just depends.
So now you have all the data, as much as you could. What's next?
Yeah, so we're constantly getting more data. We're not stopping there. we've been able to show some promising results early on. Now we're going to take our model And with the current, some of our clinical partners, they're going to be shipping us samples in the coming weeks.
What do you mean by clinical partners?
So the PIs that we're working with. Exactly. Yeah. So the ones who have these sample data sets from patients who have cancer patients in the indications that we're focusing on. We're looking at patients who first take a sample of their gut microbiome prior to treatment and then during treatment. So different time points. And we want to see the difference what's happening to their gut microbiome and whether or not they're responding to the treatment.
And you know that because you run it against your data warehouse that you have been collecting.
So we know it's responding because the physicians are telling us that they're responding, and they'll give us those data points to classify responders versus non-responders. But then when we look at the samples from those responders versus non-responders, when we sequence it, we can start seeing the differences in the type of bacteria they have and the genes that they have from their gut microbiome. So the genetic material for responders has differences than those that don't respond. And we want to identify the genetic material and try to use that as a potential first phase of drug discovery, like identify the genes and then express those genes. And they will produce these molecules in a heterologous expression system to look and see what is those bacteria are producing. And those could be potential new drugs, the starting points of new drugs.
Okay.
And what's valuable about this, you know, the big takeaway from not your traditional drug discovery company for us is drug discovery sources drugs currently from plants, from soil, or they'll do some rational drug design in the lab. The challenge of that is you do not know whether these drugs, these molecules are identifying will be safe or effective. And you won't know until you go into human trials. Mm-hmm. Which is usually $1 billion later and years later. So our takeaway is, well, what if we sourced drugs directly from the human microbiome, your own body? Logically speaking, it should be safe because it's coming from something you're producing internally.
Right.
And our models are telling us which molecules are potential signals for high efficacy. So now we are sourcing drugs from an area where there's a finite amount of molecules. And you just have to screen them based on the signals that we identify that says this is a responder, it's safe, and it's showing that it should be a high efficacy. Mm-hmm. And the way we validate efficacy is by looking at literature today, trying to understand, do the genes we've identified, are they associated with any bacteria that are causing some type of response or immunomodulatory response? Mm-hmm. So that's your in silico validation, all computational. Okay. The next phase is taking your genes and expressing them, which we are right now fundraising to complete.
So are you shifting away now, doing more of this work, trying to do more drug discovery?
So yeah, last August, you know, when I first told you we're talking about clinical trial screening as a diagnostic, for many reasons, we were told that it's a very challenging space to fundraise for diagnostics. It's very hard to scale. Investors are not as interested. But the therapeutic space is a very big opportunity. A lot of investors, especially with all these
Did it
AI,
say why?
Why what?
I mean, everybody always say diagnostic is hard to fund, but then at the same time, you hear a lot of tech people invest in diagnostic. It seems like they're very fascinated with diagnostic.
You're absolutely right. I mean, when you look at some of the funds, I'm not an expert in looking at diagnostics, but some of these companies have raised hundreds of millions of dollars, almost $1 billion, and some of them over $1 billion. And you look at the founders or the people who are helping raise the funds, a lot of them come from technology backgrounds.
Yeah, why is the tech people interested in a diagnostic?
I would say tech people are interested in big problems, and they want to start applying the challenges, the engineering skill set that they know, and they've been very successful with other fields, and apply it to healthcare, an area where they believe is a very rewarding experience. Mm-hmm. There's many tech entrepreneurs who've been successful. One example is a great company called Tempus. The founder of that was one of the founders of Groupon.
Okay.
And Tempus is kind of like Foundation Medicine, where they're taking tumor samples and they're making some predictions on response to treatment and, you know, trying to basically understand the tumor. But the idea is that these people from tech backgrounds are applying the money they've made into this field where they know they're more passionate about
it. They probably also think that they have a lot of understanding and skill set that they can transfer from the tech to the – coming from the tech, now you're in the healthcare. How much of that is – transferable and how much is something that you learned that's so different from the tech that yeah. you did not know until you were in healthcare and it took quite a big of learning curve.
It's definitely a significant learning curve how healthcare works. But for me now, we're only specializing in the biotech space, mm-hmm. Which is very different than health IT. So because the way you're selling, you're not selling a product, you know, upfront. You're going to have to spend years working on a product that's not going to have any revenue until, you know, a few phases out. Now you could, but the goal is, for me, the learning experience was it's a completely different business model. It's a completely different way of operating in terms of showing traction and what's valuable. You know, you have to prove the science. You're not trying to sell a user and trying to gain retention and traction. And from a business standpoint, you have to think about it very differently. And there's regulations. This is a whole new field. You never think about regulation, FDA, right. and reimbursement when it comes to a software platform.
Right.
And those are things that can make or break your business.
Yeah.
So well, as you're building a drug, yes, regulations are going to come up years down the line, but you got to start thinking about them today. And you got to make sure that you're addressing the questions that they're going to come up downstream. And even from a pharmaceutical company, if they are attracted to your product or your, you know, molecule or your drug candidate, you need to make sure you're working on a drug candidate that addresses one of their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically thinking years in advance and hoping you're right, that you're funny, that you're going to get to a place that someone's going to be interested.
Coming from people who are, you know, I've been in the healthcare space for a while, and those are something that you knew, you think about all the time.
Yeah.
Does it ever, I mean, you know, sometimes when you're in that position, you always so assume it seems so obvious. How could you not know?
Oh, absolutely. I did not know. and, you know, also in technology is MVP, a minimal viable product, and test it, test and iterate. You can't iterate at a very low cost with a molecule. You have to test it and spend a lot of money, and you're hoping that, you know, there's so many signs that show, yes, this could work. And then when you get into human, comparing that to a mouse or a mammal, it completely changes.
So if that's the case, I mean, you're going back, what are you saying? The tech people want to, you know, solve large problem, make a big impact. Why many of them are attracted to the diagnostic but not the therapeutic?
You know, I don't have a very clear understanding, but my understanding is they're looking from diagnostic, it's an engineering problem, right? You can, with computation, sequencing, technology, you can, you know, with enough data, you can potentially, you know, they believe that we can solve this. Mm-hmm. I'm an engineer. This can be solved. You know, there's a lot of other things that have been solved with engineering. We can figure this out. Therapeutics is different. You have to change how the body functions. And we don't know. There's no way that you can really tell how the body is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more science. It is science, right? It's something that is hard to comprehend. And from a technology person standpoint, that you can't just build it. Now, there are companies who are developing therapeutics who are trying to engineer, manufacture little microbes that can do what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they can be successful, but it also has many challenges in itself. So diagnostic
but you're
is more,
deciding now to move to the therapeutic world.
Yes, we are in a therapeutic space for many reasons. We're looking at it in parallel. One is our platform. The more we do in a therapeutic and try to do drug discovery and looking at genes and trying to express those genes, we want, because no one really understands, going back again to the microbiome, all the different metabolites, all the different molecules are being produced. They're not characterized. They're not annotated. We don't understand them yet. And so our platform will be able to start looking at what's happening in your gut and make those connections. And the smarter it gets by doing in a high throughput manner, looking at those genes, producing molecules, and feeding back into our platform, you are now creating a platform that gets smarter and smarter with its predictions while you're advancing drugs at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're generating value from the data, you're generating value from the platform, and you're generating value from the assets you're creating all together in parallel. It's a very big vision. It's going to be very challenging, but you know that someone's going to try to do it.
Yeah.
And we have an exciting team who has good skill, but we also know, you know, four people can't do this on their own. So today we're just trying to show early signs of validation, have a compelling story, and hopefully we can find the people who believe in us to make it happen.
So are you, I assume you must need science background kind of team, but you have a few.
Yeah.
And but then they seem to have other job at the same time.
Well, no. So They're actually full time.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yeah, but they so Kovi does have residency, but he is full time right now.
Okay.
Because they give you professional years.
Okay.
And you know, and yeah, everyone's actually full time working with us.
Okay.
We were able to, you know, because we're now in the Lumen Accelerator, so they're supporting us, and the goal is to keep us full time as we have to fundraise, and usually. Illumina has a successful track record of helping you do that. Once you graduate from their program, you've generated a lot of internal data, made some value out of it, and hopefully someone is excited about it.
So how much are you raising?
Today, our pre-seed is a small, fair amount of $500,000. We're almost there. And then in the late fall, we're actually looking for a $4 million round. The $500 is for our proof of concept of going from a gene to a molecule. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we want to scale that process and also advance the molecules that we've identified through some in vitro and in vivo validation.
And you just follow through the regular drug discovery?
Yeah, traditional process.
While
we're always developing our platform and trying to make it smarter at the same time.
Okay.
You know, we don't want to have to do this whole process the same way over and over again. We want to accelerate and scale it and make it more efficient. The smarter your platform, the better predictions, the less validation you need to start doing to screen for the right molecules. And you'll have higher confidence.
Yeah. And so who are your current investors?
So we have Plug and Play has been another accelerator, but they also have an investment arm. They've been very helpful to us. Actual cash came from them. We've got some awards from different competitions we've done. We have a few people who are committed, but I'll leave them disclosed for now just because they haven't fully moved forward. And then we've had, of course, in-kind services from Illumina giving us a significant amount of money for running the sequencing, companies like Amazon giving us credits for computing. So while we're very lean, we've generated a lot of value through in-kind services and the right partners to help us generate our proof of concept, and we're almost there for the next phase. But now we have to go to the lab and do the work to prove out going from sequencing a stool sample all the way to a molecule and then showing some value from that molecule.
It's interesting because you feel like, you know, the company, Ubiome.
Yes.
Right? They're also starting out with the microbiome.
Correct.
And diagnostic. Now they're also moving to it. The drug discovery. It's kind of interesting to see the transition. I mean, I have not talked to them why they moved that way. But it's I wonder if probably they face the same.
You know, you can think about it as like 23andMe. You know, they are working on giving you consumers, getting to know their ancestry, understand their health, and getting these consumers to share surveys on their personal well-being. Right. But in the back end, they're getting all this valuable data, and they are now closing great partnerships with large pharmaceutical companies for drug discovery. So there's different business models, and the bigger vision is to help cure these diseases, but it starts with helping consumers understand their body. Ubiome is doing that exact same thing. They want you to help understand your gut. What's different about your gut versus your DNA? Your DNA doesn't change. You're born with it. Your microbiome is constantly changing. And so understanding how it functions and looking at if you have a digestive issue, for example, can you change your diet? Can you change your habit, your region that you live in? Various different factors will influence your gut. And you can do these small tests at home based on like changing your food and seeing how you feel.
Right.
But by generating all this data, you know, it took them time. They first started just providing an assessment, you know, take-home test to basically samples. And now they're realizing there's a lot, you know, they have a strong data science team and they're trying to figure out, well, what can we do with this to potentially find discoveries from the microbiome for drugs?
Yeah.
They haven't disclosed more than that, but it makes complete sense to go into that field.
Yeah.
Everyone has a different method of how they want to address this drug discovery, looking at the microbiome. Some companies are looking at bugs as drugs, which is looking at probiotics. Others are looking at actual molecules. They have their pros and cons from both sides.
That'll be exciting to see what's next from all this whole microbiome space.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we've been hearing about the microbiome for many, many years now.
No, of course. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into a unique healthcare solution. For more information, visit their website at iolifescience.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So Karim, earlier you mentioned about, you know, going back way back when you started your first company, how, you know, the importance of getting the right advisors to be part of the team. Those are something that you learn, you know, by doing it. And is there any other advice that you can give to entrepreneurs who are, now that you're in the healthcare space, who are interested in being in the healthcare space? What kind of things that you learned that you wish somebody told you?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of things I can talk about.
How about top three?
Well, I'll say, you know, what we're doing and facing right now in the fundraising component, raising in the life science space is very challenging, and in every field it is. But understanding how to tell the right story and knowing when to start your fundraising, and most importantly, knowing who to fundraise from. And I stress that because we were talking to technology investors, mm-hmm. we are talking to life science investors, and they all have their different areas of focus, and they all have the different methods of what they look for in a company. Technology wants a company that will have revenue in the next couple of years. Life science can wait a longer time. Mm-hmm. However, a life science company
wants more data,
more science, rather than just the platform. The platform sounds great, but will it produce me a drug? When you have some lab validation, come back to me. Mm-hmm. So trying to create a biotech company and finding who are the right people today as your early first money in is going to be based on people who like you, believe in you, and are excited about the field. Mm-hmm. And you have to show some type of traction. And that took us almost a year to find out. So I would say the main thing is really, really spend time understanding who is your actual investor. Because a lot of people will take your time to be educated in your space because mm-hmm. that's their job as an investor. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to invest.
And how would you know who would be? I mean, you said that it took you a year. Is this something that somebody could have told you right away? Or is this sometimes you need to go through the whole process?
Yeah, I know. And I came from sales. So it's a combination of understanding how to tackle your pipeline of potential deals. So in this situation, it's looking for a right investor. But really understanding the investors and the promises that they make and how they, you know, the people can tell you. But when you do it, that's the best way of learning. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll get a lot of promises from people who say, I'll give you a decision in a couple of weeks or tomorrow, and it ends up being 3 months. So clarity, knowing how to build urgency with those investors and targeting the right people is based on talking to the field. Actually, a great way to do it is look at the companies that you believe are similar to you mm-hmm. and who is investing in them. Not the later stage Series A, Series B, but the very first money. Sometimes they're going to be actually just senior people in the pharma industry who've done this so many times. So it's not necessarily challenging to bet on them up front. Mm-hmm. But if there are people, learn about the profiles of these other companies. Who are they? And where are they getting their money, their first money from is a great source. Mm-hmm. And I think if I want to drop some names, Crunchbase has been valuable. Cypher Bio focuses on specifically life science investments. It's still a newer platform, but has great sources and announcements of here's money raised by X company and here are all the investors. Okay. So then go on LinkedIn or go through your network and try to find those investors and say, hey, I'd like to talk to you.
I see.
And find the intersect of these companies that are doing these investors who are interested in emerging technology. They're willing. There are technology investors, but they're willing to wait 10 years for a return. That's not very common, but there's mm-hmm. companies like organizations like that. Mm-hmm. So finding those groups, sometimes they're called deep tech firms and are willing to be patient because you're working on a problem that takes time and they have the appetite.
Yeah. So. Okay. Any other
advice? You can go back to the team, you know, the different roles and responsibilities. We don't like to use titles in our group, but we have to have them. But internally, we don't use them. And understanding which everyone's responsibility is and letting them own that specific portion of it and trusting in them, but also being a source to give them feedback. And being very open and transparent with how you're feeling, not just about the company, but just in general. You need to understand the awareness. Everyone has different priorities outside this company. Mm-hmm. And we have to accommodate to that to make sure that we're keeping the trust between the core group. If you don't have that trust, it's not going to go anywhere.
You need to have that personal relationship.
Yes. Friends first. We always look out for each person's personal life first, even if it's going to sacrifice the company. But that's a decision you have to make as a team.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. That make it like a family.
Yeah, it is. Small family of four.
Yeah. Soon we'll be growing.
Yeah.
So before we end, I always like to ask what book that you read.
Yeah, so I like to read a lot. Primarily, listen, I use Audible significantly. One of the most interesting books that really has really helped me think about things recently is learning how to run a company, but also work-life, not balance, but experience of how to address those things, is a book called Principles, Life and Work.
Okay.
It's a business book written by the founder of Bridgewater Associates. His name is Ray Dalio. He's one of the most well-known investors in the world. Bridgewater is a private company, I believe. That's the fifth largest amount of money being managed in the world. Anyway, so Ray Dalio is a phenomenal leader and talks about how to run your company, how to be very transparent, not conventional ways to do things.
Is this almost like his memoir from the business side?
Yes.
Okay.
And he also talks into some of your personal life, but mainly talking about who are the right people to bring on in your team as you grow your company. It's not necessarily designed just for a team of four. It starts to be more useful as you grow your company. And how to be very transparent.
And what do you mean? Everybody say that, right?
Like
transparent.
Don't keep your feelings outside the room and just be, it's all business. We're just trying to help each other. Don't take things personal and just be very honest.
And maybe I should read that book. I'm curious now. Is that sometimes you do say that.
Yes.
And people are still people.
Yes, yes.
And then you say, keep your feeling out. And the receiving ends always never feel like that sometimes. And how do you manage that?
I think, you know, people are never open, especially you're working with introverts, extroverts, a variety of people. Scientists think very differently than business people. And you have to take that into account. So something I think helped our team is we wanted to understand people's personalities and how they function. You know, not everyone's going to share everything, which is fine. But you need to understand how to reciprocate their conversations with them. And be sure that when you're communicating, you communicate in a style that works for their personality.
Okay.
And so understanding that is important. Second is taking time to take a step back and understand how people are feeling. If you can do this weekly, great. So when we do our team meetings, we do our all hands once a week. The first 10, 15 minutes, sometimes 30, depending on how much we want to share, is how are we feeling? Mm-hmm. And it really helps the framework for the rest of the conversation for our actual business topics.
Interesting.
And makes people feel more comfortable and at ease that no one here is judging you. And we all want to make sure you're successful. And we want to make sure that you feel comfortable sharing with us. And we'll be honest. And it's never personal. It's just what's best for the business. And once you have that established relationship, you're going to be more willing to share. But you have to have that constantly. And as more and more times you have those conversations, whether it's in the team setting or a one-on-one, have it constantly. It just naturally people will be just more comfortable to share their opinion. Mm-hmm. And because you'll need strong. If everyone's too nice all the time and doesn't share, you're not going to build the best company.
Right.
So being transparent, having honest conversations, get to know the person's personality and how to communicate with them. And, you know, there's a lot of other great books I can suggest also.
You read that book, you tried to implement that with your team, but then your team have not read that book.
Yeah, it's
then
not,
it's how, I mean, I, how you do can, you transfer that knowledge, that understanding, so that they can also...
And you want it to be organic.
Right.
You don't want to say, hey, guys,
I read
a book. We should all follow it exactly how it's saying. Like even Ray Dalio says, take this and make it your own.
I see.
That's what I do with all the books I read. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily here's a framework, we have to follow this. It's opening the conversation and let people share their thoughts to one another of what do you think about this idea? you know, we're not there yet to adopt a lot of the different parts because, again, it's for a growing company. Right. But some of it is just being transparent with one another and being honest and just letting us know how you feel about things and don't take things personal. It's not easy to do. You just have to have that conversation.
Right.
And just do it over and over, little by little.
Yeah.
And be supportive. Like, you have to share the wins. The small wins are very important. The more times you share those wins and let the people feel like, you know, commending the work they've done, it goes a long way. Just yeah. little pieces here and there.
Yeah. Small little things in life that actually make a huge difference.
A huge difference. And I know people understand that and they've heard this, but I don't see people do this.
It's especially when you're stressed out, then you tend to feel like you ran out of time and you just focus on things that have not been done.
Yes. And you know, actually one last thing to mention is having these tough conversations when things are also good.
Right.
If you have it when things are a little tough, then a lot of personal emotions come out and people are going to be irrational. Mm-hmm. But when you have it when things are good, people are more rational and more receptive. And it's not about arguing. You don't want to argue just my way, your way. It's more about understanding and meeting in a what's the best decision for the company.
Right. Yeah. No, this is good. I think that's applied to many things.
Many things.
In life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So principles, life, and work.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, great. Well, thank you.
No, thank you very much.